It's Monday the 9th of December, and I'm with Nana Otu Oyotu, Executive Director of Forward, the Foundation for Women's Health Research and Development. Forward is the leading African women's rights organisation in the UK, working to end violence against women and girls. Nana is sharing her experience of working in the women's voluntary and community sector and campaigning for women's rights for the Sisters Doing It For Themselves archive. Nana, if you could begin by sharing with us what influenced you to work for women's rights and in the women's sector.
I think what influenced me was when I did my studies in the university, and I went to school in Ghana, and I've always been a fighter for rights, primarily because of my home situation. And I think having gone to university and met a group of friends, we started talking about women's issues at a time when gender issues were not even sexy. That was early 1977. And that's when I realized that it was a passion of mine to continue to work on women's issues. And that's how I got into the sector, through my studies. And immediately after my studies, I actually got a call from a lady who was looking for a counterpart to work on women's issues in Northern Ghana. And that's when I started working with women in agriculture. Then I went on to work with women in entrepreneurship, particularly looking at women who were in rural areas and who didn't have access to any form of resources, particularly access to banks and microcredit. So that's how I really started. And a lot of the work involved not just looking at microcredit, but also looking at women's personal lives and the need to build women's confidence. And I always remember one story of a woman who, when she was asked what had been the greatest benefit of the project, and for her it was like the fact that she could walk into a bank, and when she saw the police officer in front of the bank, she could walk past him confidently. And it just struck me, I mean, some of these basic things that you take for granted. And this is something that was a huge barrier for a lot of rural women in accessing basic banking facilities. So it really made me think much more about women's rights and women's voices and the need to build women's capacity. But when I did my master's in Success University, it then went into the whole area of sexual and reproductive health. And I realized that that was an issue that had been around me for a long time, but I had not necessarily looked into it. So my long essay at the time was really around sexual and reproductive health and rights, and that opened up whole conversations around sexual and reproductive health, violence against women and girls, and the need to really work towards this. And I think there was a conference in Brighton in 1996 or 1997 on violence against women and girls. And it was a huge conference. I do remember that the whole place was buzzing. And I heard about female genital mutilation. And I heard a woman talking about her story, her experience. And she was at the time a volunteer with Forward. And that really struck a huge chord to me. And I was like, I come from Ghana. I've never experienced FGM. I'd worked in Northern Ghana and I hadn't come across anybody who had had FGM. But clearly I was working in an area that was happening. And considering that I wasn't from that ethnic community, it meant that I was saved from FGM. And I just always told myself that it could have been me. I could have been born in Northern Ghana. I could have gone through FGM. And I really would have wanted somebody to sort of speak on my behalf or to support or to advocate for this to end. And I think that really made me put myself in the shoes of, you know, those who've gone through FGM. And it really made me think about not really being a bystander, but to be actively involved. So in my organization at the time, I started working with the International Planned Parenthood Federation, and I really started to talk about this issue, find out how we could really work towards addressing this issue in a much more strategic way. So that really pushed me, you know, into this work on women's rights within the UK. And it wasn't just women in the UK, but it was, for me, women on the global south and the global north as well, because I was working in an international organization. So it gave me exposure to a number of countries, but a number of issues. And that really, really pushed me into this arena of women's rights. Yeah.
When you were working in Northern Ghana with microcredits, were you working for NGOs?
Yes. I was, I think I've only worked once for a government organization, and I think, and even that, I was directly working with women. And with the NGO, it was a women's credit organization. It had just been established at the time, and that's when I got the opportunity to work as a training coordinator. So I also love training. So it's really part of my work around training people to get confidence, but also training people to understand the issues and to be able to work much more effectively. So that's been how I was ushered into the work.
You've talked about what influenced your decision. Did the Women's First Refuge in the UK have any impact on your decision making?
I mean, the reality is, I came to the UK long after the Women's Refuge, and I do, when the first refuge was set up, and I do recognize the added value of a Women's Refuge in the whole structure of support and provisioning of care for women, primarily because when I worked in sexual reproductive health, and this was in, I started in 1996. There was very little discussion on gender-based violence. And I recall the work started in the Western Hemisphere, actually Venezuela. The Family Planning Association of Venezuela started to really ask questions within the consultation. And they realized that women were desperate to talk about the experiences of intimate partner abuse, but the doctors and the providers were not ready. And so the consultant who was sitting in the consulting room observing basically came to the conclusion that there was a huge problem and everybody was ignoring the problem, primarily because they didn't have the skills. And so these women would have nowhere to go. When they came to the clinics, nobody was also listening to them. And that really started the work on tackling gender-based violence, and really working with professionals, the clinicians, but also working with the receptionists and everybody. So it was like a whole systems approach. And the other part of it was identifying refuges within the country where women could be referred to. So for me, that is where access to a refuge should be part of the package of care and support, because it's not everybody who can safely go home. And there are a lot of women who go home and end up dead. So I think the refuge really provides that added haven for women to be able to, you know, access some kind of support and start to rebuild their lives. So yes, this is how it resonates with me. By UK starting to put up the first refuge, it really meant that women could now start to have that needed support.
Okay. Who inspired you and who inspires you now?
That's a big, big, big question. And I always say that the person who inspired me has always been my mother. This was also because my mother wasn't that much educated, but she was very clear about what she didn't want in her marriage life. And I recall that in conversations with her, by the time I realized that, you know, my mom had, you know, about three marriages, and she said she walked out of her first marriage, which was an arranged marriage. The second one too was really arranged because somebody, her brother, introduced her to my father. And the third one was a love marriage. And so right from the beginning, it was like I was very clear that if you go into a relationship and it doesn't work, you can walk out. And that confidence that my mum had in her life and to be independent and to really also reach out to people. And I never saw my mum and my stepfather having a bad word with each other. And I thought that was such a good role model. And in my, although I'd never stayed with my mother, I stayed mostly with my father and stepmothers. I noticed that my father was violent to some of my stepmothers. And I think that made me see the difference in a woman who was confident and a woman who was determined to make a difference in the lives of others. So I think that really was why my mom has always been my role model. I mean, I also have other role models. And I think in terms of other women who have been role models for me, I always think about Winnie Mandela. And I just think that clearly she was so much involved in the apartheid movement, and that if Winnie hadn't been there, South Africa could never have gained that independence. And it's always interesting how such strong women are almost always vilified at the end. And I think that for me was also the challenge, you know. And but I think it's important for women to have that kind of leadership and really fight for women's rights. And I think that's something that I see also in my mum. She died 15 years ago, and also in Winnie Mandela. Bless her, she's also died. Yes.
How would you describe leadership?
I think for me, leadership is, and I always tell, because we do leadership training for young women, and I always say that we can all be leaders. Nobody is born a leader. And when you ask the question, who is your role model, or is your, you know, who do you see as your role model? A lot of people also talk about their mothers, and they always said their mothers were also shy or that kind of thing, but they definitely saw their mothers as role models. So for me, it's about leadership involves working towards a particular goal with people and enabling people to make decisions or take them to a particular journey. And that's how I see a leader in terms of, and a leader can be in any walk of life, and depending on, you know, a small task would need a leadership role. A huge task, you know, would need a leadership role. So, yes, for me, a leader is about having the capacity and the ability to engage people to meet a particular goal that's been set.
Can you give an example of your leadership in action?
Haha, that's interesting. I think my leadership has always been having come to Forward as the executive director. And I actually was also on the board for about maybe 8 years before I became the executive director. So I was very much aware of my role in helping to set the direction and helping to set goals, helping to steer the organizational development. And my role at Forward has, I've always seen it as a collaborative role in helping others, because I wasn't the only one who made decisions, but working together with the team to be able to develop our vision, to be able to develop our program areas in supporting women and girls who've been affected by female genital mutilation, but also working with building capacity of others who have come along. And I think what I've been really excited about has been the work to build capacity of young people who've come through our organizations. And I've seen them come in as interns or volunteers who either want to do, you know, work in the area or want to get into the sector. And I've seen quite a lot of them come through and really gone up to, you know, a number of organizations and gone to places. And for me, that is the role of leader, to be able to help people to flourish and help people to sort of gain their voice and regain their vision in life and to sort of move and thrive.
Does any particular intern come to mind? Could you describe one in particular and their journey?
I think for me the most interesting, I've got a few, but I will talk about the two of them. And Angela is one who came in as an intern. Primarily she contacted us because she was doing her first degree and had come across FGM and was interested in doing work in her university to raise awareness. So we had a Young People Speak Out program where we recruited young people to take part in a youth advocates program, and she applied for it. And when she applied, she was given a small sub grant as part of the training. It was a residential training, and then she was given a small grant to undertake an intervention in, she was in Essex University at the time. And when she did her intervention, it actually gained so much interest in the university that she requested to repeat it the year after. And when she finished her degree, she contacted us to see whether she could work there as an intern. So Angela came in as an intern, but she came in just at the time that we had started our young women's leadership program, which is called Tuwezeshe. So Angela came in as an intern, and within 2 years, she'd gone from intern to a program assistant to a program officer who was leading the leadership program. And today she's gone off to work with the UN, and she's working with the UN volunteers in Nigeria. And it's so exciting to see. And I remember when she was leaving, she was crying and she was so upset. But she said, it was something that we had given her the confidence, and Angela was leading the leadership training program. She'd been so instrumental in helping to set up a young women's hub. And that for me was like, seeing her mom. Her mom sent us a letter, to say thank you. She gave us presents, when Angela left. And that was like, I was so excited that I had helped her through her journey. And she continues to be in touch. I mean, like almost every other week she's on WhatsApp with us, Nana, this is what's happening, Nana. I've met another, woman who reminds me so much of you, and she gives me so many opportunities. And it was the opportunities that, we gave Angela, and we pushed her and pushed her, but gave her the support to grow and to thrive. And I think that was a good example. The other one was also another young woman we worked with, Saria. And Saria also came in as an intern with our young women's program. And after 6 months, normally the internship was 6 months, and she said no, she wanted to stay on for another 6 months. So we agreed for her to stay on another 6 months. And then within that period, the youth program officer left because she'd got an opportunity to go to Brazil to do an internship program. So we asked Saria to come on board as a program assistant. And from then on, she went on to lead the youth program and became the youth program coordinator till she decided she wanted to go and do her master's. And that's when she left the organization. But I think there were issues with her going to her master's, and she then asked to do, then I recommended her to actually do some work with Rosa. And that's when she was taken on to work with Rosa as part of the Tackling FGM initiative. Today she's working as a program manager in Oldham, working on violence against women and girls. And at each stage we have to be writing, references for these girls. And it's really exciting. So that's my journey and how we've sort of, example of two young women that we have sort of brought up, and we still continue to stay in touch.
And how, or do you think, women's leadership is different from men's?
I mean, I think women's experiences are different in terms of the I would say, the intersectional challenges that women face. One, because women's leadership is within a wider patriarchal system where women's voices and women's leadership is not as recognized because of the fact that, you know, the patriarchal system really entrenches you know, men's power as the most important, and women are not necessarily seen in the same status as men, and so there is discrimination in terms of access to leadership roles. There's more competition within, and I think because of women's general experience of discrimination, gender inequality, it often means that I see that particularly in the women's sector, there's more of a focus on women's specific needs. And I always think about the Caroline Moses issue about strategic gender needs as well as the practical. So there is the practical issues, and then there is the strategic in order to address women's particular needs. And for me, it's also about seeing the areas where women are more likely to sort of want to sort of work in. So like with the women's sector, we are seeing that the focus is primarily on discrimination, abuse of women's rights, and to get women's voices and address violation of women's rights and issues around discrimination, tackling violence against women in particular, but also looking at women's sisterhood. And that then means that for women, we have particular issues and interests that are very different from men. And these issues are often not recognized by men. And so the need for women's, and I would say that very often, I mean, women's leadership is very much linked to a kind of feminist approach, which is really about, you know, addressing discrimination, equality of opportunity, equality of access, and those kind of related things that really enable women to have the agency to make decisions in their lives and to be able to thrive in their lives and in their relationships. So it's quite different from men's, where it's actually more around competition and very much around, you know, really getting, you know, one person's voice heard over another. And so I tend to see those are different. But again, you find quite a lot of women too who would have those kinds of entrenched patriarchal attributes as well in terms of their leadership role. I do recall in one of our leadership trainings where we did a case study on an organization in particular, and it was a very much, it was supposed to be a women's feminist organization, but their attributes were so similar to male dominated, you know, patriarchal systems. And a lot of the young women said, oh, I can see my organization that. So I do know that, you know, there are, it's not every women's organization that's a feminist organization. So we need to also differentiate that.
You talked earlier about practical and strategic issues. Can mm-hmm. you expand on that? What you meant by it?
I mean, for me, the practical is, you know, issues are what are the practical things around women's practical things that need to be done to enable women to thrive. So access to childcare is one basic thing. I mean, if in an organization, if women don't have access to adequate childcare, you definitely cannot contribute as effectively. So flexible working hours are those practical things that you really need to sort of ensure that you put in place for women to be able to work, and to get women, you know, able to give off their time and to sort of take holidays when it's school holidays and those kinds of things. So in an organization, you have to sort of make that work for women. At the same time, you need to sort of think about the strategic, which is about enabling women to have the voice, to sort of have opportunity to sort of build their agency, to build a movement, to link up with other women, and to create that space for women to develop. So I think for me, those are the kinds of differences I'm seeing in terms of the practical things that would, support women to sort of work better vis-a-vis the strategic ones that you sort of enable women to sort of link up with other women's organizations, partnership working, and all those kinds of things that would enable women's organizations to sort of be more, to be much stronger, and because you do need these kinds of building solidarity. And one of the things that we have increasingly been seeing in our organization as also very, very important in terms of the practical needs, the issue of self-care. And I think increasingly we're seeing that in the sector. And it's something that we constantly have to sort of bring into our work and to sort of ensure that women's needs are addressed in that issues of burnout and all those kinds of things, and giving them opportunity to sort of get that, rejuvenation of their energy and,
You've touched on this. What motivates you as a leader, and how have you developed your leadership style?
I mean, what really motivates me is the fact that I can be part of change, and to see some of the examples or the people we've worked with or the organizations we have sort of worked with, thriving and really going on to make a change in other people's lives. And I always tell myself that, I mean, you can't be everywhere, but you can influence and shape other people. And I think the ability to give off support and enable and create that kind of opportunities for others to make a difference is really, really amazing. And it's the thing that really gets me really excited. You go somewhere and you see maybe the young people you've worked with who've gone off to do other things. They're so excited to see you and to tell you their successes and to tell you how that has changed their lives, And also you see the organizations we've worked with. And I always mention an organization in particular in Bristol, Refugee Women of Bristol. And when we started working with them, about 10 years ago, it was very much like they were very much not interested in, these women's issues. They were just doing practical things for women. Refugee women, you need to have know how to sort of fill in your forms. You know how to access, benefits, etc. But when it came to really tackling issues around their lives and making decisions around, violence and FGM and related things, they were really not touching on those kinds of things. And we started with a conversation around whether FGM was an issue in Bristol. And they said, no, it's not an issue. I said, let's do research. So we actually gave them skills and to do participatory research. We trained, recruited the community women, trained them as researchers, and worked with them over 3 months to conduct the participatory research. And then afterwards, as part of that research, we create a platform to engage community stakeholders, but also policymakers around the issues. And that was the turning point for all of them. And they all said, look, we didn't realize this was an issue. We never knew. I mean, because we're not talking about these issues. And they all came from communities where, yes, they had been affected by FGM, but it's like, it's happened. So what? It's part of my life. But now they had seen that they needed to sort of take action. So this was something that in the last 10 years has transformed the organization, and Refugee Women have now become a very, very critical organization in Bristol, working with refugees, taking on more strategic issues around violence against women and girls, looking at broader issues that affect women, but also engaging with policymakers. So they are now part of the delivery group on FGM. They have opportunities to speak, and their income has grown. And I mean, this is also because of the partnership we've had with them over the last 10 years. So these are the things that really motivate you, and you see that, well, you're actually influencing and shaping the lives of women. Last, no, I think it's early October, we went to, as part of the program, we do a lot of partnership work with them, and we went to a program in Madrid, and six of the women decided to, get a sort of a flat and spend a holiday in Madrid. I mean, it took a few days after their training, and I was so excited. And but later on, I just said, Hang on. I hope you people are not going to make your husbands feel that we have actually started you on this journey and we are going to be in trouble and can't go to Bristol. They said, no, we are okay now, you know. And to think that these were Muslim women who were really, really excited about taking, you know, initiatives and doing things by themselves. I was really impressed. Yeah. So those are some of the things that really motivate me. Really seeing that, you know, the little seeds that you're sowing is really making a change. And it makes you feel excited. And at Forward, we do celebrate a lot. In my organization, we do celebrate a lot. We celebrate the little gains, you know, birthdays, you know, bring cakes and eat. You know, somebody's leaving, we bring cakes and eat. Somebody brings flowers and things. So it really is to keep us all happy. And because the issues we deal with are huge. And sometimes they can be really, really depressing. And if you don't really hook onto something to keep you motivated, you're really always going to go home very saddened. So I think that's why we keep ourselves motivated in this way.
How have you developed your leadership style over the years that you've worked?
You know what? I mean, I like to learn a lot. And I remember when I came to Forward, I didn't really know much about finance. And I had to learn how to, you know, I was saying that if you need to be a leader, you should understand the things that you're going to sort of work with, and one is finance, the other is, you know, management styles and management skills, and to know how to work with people, to support people, to really understand organizational systems, organizational processes. So those basic organizational processes I had to sort of learn. And in terms of my personal skills, I've actually built a lot in terms of, you know, public speaking, understanding how to sort of present your case, advocacy, and learning how to sort of build stronger partnerships and what it really means to develop partnerships and, you know, really getting evidence based around some of these things. And one of the things I've been really interested into has been participatory research. And that in itself it's about creating the evidence with the people so you're working with to be able to understand. And so I've come from that angle of participation and getting people to participate. And so I do it in different ways in the organization. Yeah. And that's how I've learned to build my leadership skills. Yeah.
How has your involvement in the sector impacted on you personally?
I think I always say that initially our work had been at Forward on tackling just female genital mutilation, because that was an issue that basically nobody was really looking at. And so it was very much, how do we open up conversations? How do we engage women? How do we engage young people? But increasingly, we found there were links between UK and countries of origin. There were also links in Europe. And so the need for us was to build partnership with others, because we couldn't do it alone. And we were also increasingly seeing that other organizations were starting on the issue. So it was about us sharing our lessons with them. And some of them too, it was about us initiating. So I do remember when we had to sort of, you know, lobby for funding for tackling violence, more funding for FGM work, particularly community-based work, because there wasn't that kind of a strategic focus. The government was really interested in, you know, provisioning of services, safeguarding, but not necessarily community engagement. And we were clear that, you know, tackling these issues were social norms. You had to sort of work with communities. So I think that's where we came from, working with others in the sector and contributing our knowledge to the wider violence against women and girls sector. But what also transpired quite easily was, or at a very early stage, was the fact that we were seeing that people were working in silos. So if there was work on domestic violence, it really didn't overlap with work on forced marriage. It didn't overlap with work on FGM. But for us, we came from the angle that we were seeing overlaps, because a woman who goes through FGM would almost always sometimes marry early. She would also be affected by domestic violence. We're seeing a number of our community girls talking about, you know, rape, and nobody was really looking at that. So we have in the last 5 years really had to sort of look at the multiple links. And us as an organization, we have very early on in our development or in our work started to also do international development work. So whilst we're engaging the sector in the UK, we're also engaging partners. And that gave us a rich understanding of some of the issues, particularly the work in European level. So we were co-founders of the NFGM European Network, and we were quite clear about the fact that our communities were quite similar in other parts of Europe. And it really made more sense to sort of collaborate and get to really do the things that others were doing, learning from them, but also sharing our learning with them. So that's how we worked with the sector. And right from the beginning, Forward as a lead organization also contributed our part to existing women's sector. So we were part of the Women's Health and Equality Consortium, which was also led by quite a consortium of about 7 organizations at that time, which came together to inform and shape decisions about women's rights for the Department of Health. We've been part of other spaces, including the Ascent project, where we've come from a sector that's really dealing with not only women affected by FGM, but also with refugee, migrant women, etc. Perspective. So that meant that we really started to sort of engage with the sector. We've been part of the MOPAC initiative also on tackling violence against women and girls, and bringing in the element of training and really engaging. So I think that's how we've really linked up with the sector. And it has then meant that the sector is becoming much more robust in trying to sort of bring in other voices and other issues, because, you know, violence against women is a huge challenge. Yeah.
And has there been any impact on you personally, on a personal level?
Impact in what way?
Has it affected your life in any way, your life outside your work environment?
To be honest, my kids always tell me that I never relax, and it's because for me, I enjoy my work. And so I will work throughout and come home and still continue to work. Luckily, I've got a good husband who knows how to cook well. So I really don't have to cook much at home. So by the time, and he had been unwell for the last 2 years, so really being at home now, he enjoys cooking. And really it means that I can still travel and do a lot of my gallivanting and doing working without having to sort of cook. And the kids are grown now. So in that sense, but I think you do need to have a very supportive environment, supportive system to be able to sort of work in this sector, particularly in a leadership role. If you have kids and things, and I think I also had a family that was also very supportive. In fact, my kids have all been very, very supportive of the work and have helped along the way. So that's been the issue. Some people have had backlash in terms of their work, and I haven't had that backlash, primarily because I tend to work a lot with everybody, and I always feel that everybody has something to offer, you know. So I think that's what's really made me quite quite a crucial, you know, connector in the system. And I haven't really seen that kind of backlash in terms of my personal life. I definitely would love to do other things that I love doing. I mean, I love dressmaking. I never had time to do it unless I have to stitch a few things here and there. But I mean, those are things I love. I've got grandkids now, so I do have to spend some time with them. So sometimes I'll close work and then go and spend the night and stay over with my daughter and then go back to work in the morning. So I do a lot of things, and I try to sort of do different things in between. But I think increasingly I'm seeing that it's a huge challenge trying to sort of do succession planning, and I think that's where I'm becoming really, really concerned, because we're seeing the young people come in, but they don't really stay long. They come in and go, they come in and go. So you really don't build them to sort of really say, hey, it's time to sort of hand over. And I think that's where the challenge is going to be within the women's sector in terms of handing over and succession planning.
Now, you have touched on this. What are the issues that are dear to your heart? You've spoken about FGM. Mm. And how do you think you've influenced them? Child marriage.
Child marriage has been an issue that has been very, very dear to my heart, primarily because, I mean, when I started working with family planning, I saw it coming as this is a huge issue. I mean, I did a few publications around child marriage and was really pushing for my organization to sort of take on the, we became part of a network called the Forum on Marriage and the Rights of Women and Girls from a very early, I think in the late 90s. And that was what actually helped initiate work on forced marriage, even in the UK. And I think I was really, really excited, particularly the forced marriage unit came out of those conversations and discussions where they did some research. And it was sad that we were not able to take this to a global level, primarily because the organizations that had all come together to discuss the work on child marriage at the time, we all were passionate within our own individual organizations, and we didn't have the organizational backup in terms of, you know, really wanting to take it forward. And so as people left organizations, you know, there wasn't much interest till, you know, I think maybe about 8 years ago when the Girls Not Brides came to really now take it up as a key area of concern, and it came to the global level. But in terms of our work with the Forum on Marriage and Women and Girls, I'm really clear that that was also one of the earlier work that really sparked on the interest. We even had UNICEF take up one of our research and really, you know, take on do a much more in-depth study on child marriage. We were very instrumental even in naming it a child marriage, and initially it was like early marriage, and then we took on the term, you know, child marriage, because nobody should be married, you know, before they're 18. So yes, that was one of my biggest passion, I mean, child marriage, because I just said there was no way we should continue letting girls marry. And for me, that's also, it's a big, big cause of, you know, all the challenges around lack of agency, lack of opportunities for girls, but also domestic violence and things. And we're seeing it in a lot of the communities that we were working in, particularly in Africa. You marry at, you know, you go through FGM and then you go and get on about 12 years, you're already married. By 20, you've had about 5 children. You're already divorced or moved to about 3 or 4 men. And so that was a challenge for me. And repeatedly, we are seeing the impact on girls. So child marriage early leads to, you know, early childbearing. So that's something that really, really bothers me. Yeah.
And how have you influenced change in the area of child marriage?
I think the influencing change has been about the work we have. You know, the studies we've done we did quite a few consultations which really started the conversations around child marriage. So I can talk about what we did in the UK, where we worked with the Home Office at the time when they started the research based on the work we'd done on child marriage at the time. But also the work we've done in Tanzania has been instrumental. We started a Tanzanian project on child marriage. And today, child marriage has become a key discussion issue in Tanzania. The legal issue has still been challenging, but in the last 2 years, they've challenged the government on it. There's been a network that's been really working in Tanzania. There's been organizations that are, you know, doing work on child marriage. And that is really, for me, a huge progress in that area. So that's really makes me quite excited about, you know, the future and tackling some of these issues. Yeah.
How has Forward and the women's sector as a whole influenced and changed women's structural positions in the UK?
Forward's work, I think, has one of the things that I really get excited about Forward's work has been our nurturing role. Our nurturing role in enabling campaigners to really come up. And I do remember having the conversation with Leila Hussein when Cosmopolitan contacted me about getting somebody to talk about FGM. And I contacted Leila and I said, Leila, this is an opportunity for you if you're interested. And that's interview she did really pushed her in the media and really pushed her to, become one of the first campaigners to really start publicly talking about themselves and their experiences. And it was the same for, the establishment of the specialist services on FGM in the UK. Forward was instrumental in pushing for the establishment of these services, because these services at the time were not the existing hospitals were not providing the care that women needed. And so by pushing and working with the Harry Gordon at the time to establish the service, it then became the blueprint for other specialist services to be established. We were instrumental in the policy and development of legislation, the first legislation on FGM, and subsequently the legislation in 2003. Even the launch of the legislation was actually done in our office. So, in terms of some of these structural things around getting policies in place, we were very much at the forefront. We also supported significantly the 2004 Women's the Girls Summit, which was led by David Cameron at the time, and we then introduced a number of 2014, I think, sorry, 2014, a number of policies which changed the landscape of work on FGM. Unfortunately, I mean, we see too that there's been a backlash as a result of, too much policies, which has then mean that, communities have been sort of marginalized and discriminated against. But I think some of the things that we have been really critical in shaping in terms of strategy has also been around recognizing the role of community engagement. That is something that's taking much longer, but in places like Bristol, it's been very clear the role of community engagement in reaching communities who are affected. And we're getting more and more voices speaking out. Some of the structural things that I think we've also been effective in doing has been more at the European level, in terms of working with the NFGM European network. Forward, I was like the first president of the network for about 4 years, so we did a lot of lobbying with the European Parliament, with the Council of Europe in developing policies around FGM, but also on forced marriage and child marriage. So that, for me, was instrumental. We were involved in the conversations around the Istanbul Convention as a network. And that, for me, was also quite instrumental in the sense that it resulted in funding of organizations, increased funding in work at the European level towards work on FGM, towards work on working with migrant women affected by FGM. And that really was an opportunity to really see that without funding, organizations could not be supported. And that, for me, were some of the structural things that had been. What has started also, but I would have wanted it to sort of strengthen it, was the whole element of engaging statutory professionals. So in the issue of training. We were quite instrumental in training, particularly social workers working with midwives and nurses, and working with police and training police on issues around FGM. In the last 4 years, I think there's been a shift. There's where the police themselves have now been doing the training themselves, and there's been a stronger push on, I would say, stronger element of prosecution and safeguarding, which has really meant that there's been very limited focus on community engagement.
What do you think are the greatest achievements of women's collective action, and what still needs to be done?
I think the greatest achievement has been the push towards tackling discrimination against women at different fronts. Discrimination in terms of equal pay related matters, maternity rights, getting women to, issues around domestic violence. And I think one of the things I was really excited about, especially in tackling domestic violence, was when they started asking questions in maternity hospitals around women affected by domestic violence. I thought that was a real big shift. I'm not really sure the impact of it today, but at least these processes have started, and it opens up conversations around women and identifying women. I think the growth in women's refugees has been really, really huge. My challenge has also been the fact that there's still a lot of discrimination around particularly women with no cost to public funds, and those are the ones that are continuously being a huge barrier. But the push for comprehensive sexuality education, tackling relationship issues in schools, is a big plus for some of us. We've got like the End Violence Against Women Coalition that has been really, really instrumental in some of these issues and pushing for attention on some of these things, including I'm not sure where we're going with that, the domestic violence bill. And I thought that was something that was going to be passed, but it seems that it's now falling through the cracks, and we hope that somebody picks it up in the next parliament. The other big issue for me, it's about women's rights being also in instrumental in the UK, primarily because of the Beijing, the whole Beijing platform of action, and the fact that governments have to sort of report to CSW, and they have to also report in terms of the monitoring standards around CEDAW, has also meant that there's been pushed by the government too. And this is all part of the work of the women's collective voices. And I know WRC was really, really at the forefront of pushing on some of these reporting, the shadow reports and things, which really provide, I would say, a kind of accountability tools for the government to sort of really push on these things about women's rights and women's voices. So yes, access to health services, I think even abortion rights and things have been something that the women have actually, women's voices have made possible. But without collective voices, I think, and women sort of collaborating and working together, I think this would have been very, really challenging, and linking with policymakers. For me, at the international level, there's also the push for the Sustainable Development Goals, which have become part of the push for, you know, getting wider access to women's issues. And I think goal five is really, really strategic in terms of, which is, you know, the goal five on gender equality and empowerment of all women. And the fact that it applies to all countries then means that we really also have a strong push to push for women's representation in parliament. Although I don't think that issue is really going to be rolled back with so many, about 120 women parliamentarians have really, really resigned and, you know, decided not to go into parliament. Women's voices in parliament has been so, so instrumental, and pushing for women's voices in parliament has also been quite a strategic entry point for women's pushing women's agenda. But I'm not sure where we're going now. We are in challenging times now. Yes.
And finally, what are your thoughts on the future for women's rights?
My challenge in terms of the future for women's rights is there is this issue, particularly with the young women who have taken everything for granted and not really seeing that so many things that they're taking for granted now, people have to fight for, and really not wanting to be part of that. I think movement is frightening. The whole challenges for me around women's participation in decision-making processes, particularly in policy making, is something that I'm quite concerned about. We're having a backlash. We're having gender equality gains are being rolled back in a number of countries, and that is really frightening. I'm even shocked about this whole push for, you know, unisex toilets and that kind of thing. And I went to this program and it was like unisex toilet, and I just said, that is really challenging. There is, you know, the whole conversations around, you know, I would say women's rights, trans and all those kinds of things. It's also really areas that we really need to sort of really, really engage in and discuss. And that seems not to be the situation. And I just worry about the fact that the women's sector has really taken on change without having an equal men's sector talking about these issues around empowerment and equality. And I'm seeing it more and more in the sense that domestic violence is not reducing, sexual violence isn't reducing. And I just over and over wonder how we can really make men more engaged in leading change rather than having women to always take the responsibility of leading change, because we can only do so much. And what needs to be done is to really address the social norms, and these social norms would need to be addressed equally by men. And I think for me, that agenda of who is doing that. And yes, we cannot carry everything, but at the same time, we need to recognize that we can only do so much in terms of, you know, tackling the issues. We have to sort of get men's voices on board. And that's something that the women's sector has to. I mean, it's not for us to really take up everything, but, you know, it's not enough just picking people up, going to refugees. We have to sort of look at how do we prevent? How does prevention become, or what the effective ways of looking at prevention? So those are my issues.
Is there anything else that you would like to say that you haven't?
I think in terms of what's still there that needs to be done, I think for us in the UK, and being a woman from, you know, a BME community, I think we still have a lot to do around bringing in BME women's voices, strengthening leadership within BME organizations, but also tackling the realities that are facing young people, BME young people growing here in terms of race, identity, gender, and all these kinds of things. And that, for me, I'm increasingly seeing a lot of issues around mental health, which are coming out of all these challenges and failure to, you know, have resilience among young people. And that really is something that it's becoming increasingly a challenging problem that has to be addressed. And I don't know whether, you know, it's been addressed. It's not been addressed enough, clearly. There is an issue of, you know, mental health is coming up on the agenda. There's conversations around, but the intersecting root causes are still not being addressed. And it's just like, yes, we are picking up. It's not just picking up the pieces. We do need to sort of look at what is it that is making young women feel so uncomfortable about their bodies, feel so much vulnerable within their communities, and feel unable to sort of exercise agency and access and thrive. You know, yes, there are some who are thriving, but there are also a lot that are really being left behind. And I think we do need to sort of take this up as a huge, huge issue. Otherwise, we are going to sort of go back to this, you know, somehow, you know, us, when we're coming, we do, and I always feel that we had a, I don't know whether it was an inbuilt thing, but we had quite a bit of resilience, but really, these young people don't. And that is really, really challenging. So that's something that I really feel that it's some of the things that needs, that still really, really need to sort of be addressed. So issues around mental health of women, young women's leadership, discussing the whole intersectionalities around, you know, feminism, what it really means to be a Black woman, and, you know, the issues around, you know, parallel agendas, but to sort of really make sure that our agendas really work together. I think that is something that has to be sort of addressed.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.